The following content is provided under a Creative Commons license. Your support will help MIT OpenCourseWare continue to offer high-quality educational resources for free. To make a donation or view additional materials from hundreds of MIT courses, visit MIT OpenCourseWare at ocw.mit.edu.
And then what's going to happen after I give this presentation on paper prototyping is that we're then going to do the process where the people who want to work on a project, you call out your, you say, this is what I want to work on, I want to work on the people watching game, and then, you know, and then you say, and I've written people watching here, so find me at the end of class. And once everyone sort of declare this is the game that they're really jazzed about, it's going to be pretty much just a free-for-all. Find the team that you want to work on, and as soon as you've got your team together, you get a bunch of prototyping materials, and you have the rest of class and as much time as you would like after that, because class will be pretty much over for you at that point, to work with your team, to talk with your team, figure out what you're going to be doing, what time you're going to meet up over the weekend, for instance, to be able to start doing your homework. We have prototyping materials up front. This includes things like dice, includes things like index cards that we've been handing out, markers, poker chips, little kindergarten counters and things like that. Again, anyone who's taken CMS 608 has seen all of these before. Hex grids, more paper.
There's also on the website on Seller under design and prototyping, there are some printable hex and grid maps. You can just download. There's PDFs of them. You can download them and print them out. But we also have, you know.
Yeah, no plastic bits.
No plastic bits. Rubber
animals.
Yeah. Good for representing almost anything.
Yep. Now, we have a bunch of Ziploc bags as well. What I would suggest is every team grab one of those Ziploc bags and put everything that you need in there. If you're trying to grab more than what you can fit in a Ziploc bag, you're grabbing way too much. And don't grab absolutely more than you need. Don't worry, we'll continue working on Monday. So if you're out of stuff, you can pick it up on Monday as well, or just email us.
And you can use different colored rubber bands, paper clips.
Yeah, I mean, paper clips actually came up quite a bit.
Things you find in your dorm room will work just fine.
Yeah. But let me talk a little bit about what the goal of prototyping is. Okay, so the goal of prototyping is primarily so that you can start getting feedback on your ideas faster. Now, all of Project One is one big paper prototype. So, you know, it's kind of like that's both the prototype and the thing you're trying to build. But eventually when it comes to Project 2 and Project 3 and Project 4, the paper prototype becomes like the first step of then building your digital prototype. That's why it's not so weird to use Project 1 as the basis for Project 2. But for Project 3, you might actually just be creating a whole new paper prototype in the first couple of days to then make your digital game. And the whole idea is that you can start testing a paper game much faster than you can start testing a digital game. You can start getting feedback from regular people, from other classmates, from your instructors, from your dorm mates. It's also an opportunity for you to experiment with lots of different ways to attack the same problem. So say you're making the body part game anatomy puzzle, and there's a whole bunch of different ways that you can attack that same problem, right? You know, it could be more like a jigsaw kind of thing. It could be more like a operation don't touch the sides kind of thing. It could be a very hardcore biology puzzle where you've got like a random organ and there's no other information and you figure out where that goes. So a paper prototype lets you very quickly try out a whole bunch of different ideas. And the whole idea, and the result of that is that you're going to throw away a whole bunch of those things because you're going to churn through a whole bunch of different variants of that idea until you find one that works for you. It's also easier for you to change part of it because often when I say paper prototype, I literally mean that you're using a marker or a pen on a piece of paper. You don't even necessarily need to type things out. Eventually, if you were trying to build a board game or a card game or something, you might want to put a little production value into it. But I'm going to say that in this particular case, probably only like the rules need to be typed up at the end of the entire prototyping process. You don't actually need to worry too much about production quality when it comes to assignment one. Are we asking them to turn in photos of their pieces, like cards and stuff?
I don't think we'd ask that. I think we asked them to grading on the day that it's being graded, which is, I think, next Wednesday.
Right, well, I should just sit around and play your prototype.
We'll grab the groups out of class, we'll go play it with them, and,
yeah.
And that will be all.
And that's it. And again, you know, and if the game turns out to be not at all fun, that's fine. You had 1 week to work on it. That's not surprising.
We're not looking for fun. We're looking for a completely workable game.
So is the game will be workable with the pieces that we have and also maybe cards that we have like that?
Yeah, and you can also bring in other materials from other sources. You don't have to. You're not constrained to what we give you.
Yep. These are just to give you some ideas. And if you find other things that work better, use those.
Right.
Okay.
Here are the goals. This is what you're trying to do. First thing you're trying to do is find the fun. And you are trying to figure out what's fun about the subject material that you got. You know, is the burrito folding thing, is it more about the folding part, or is it more about the stuffing than the toppings? Is it more about the trying to figure out what this particular customer wants? You know, is it about making sure that, you know, everyone's got something too spicy, that sort of thing? So you want to be focusing on what are the choices that the player gets to make, and are those interesting choices? Are those things that have an interesting trade-offs? You know, there's no optimal strategy, and you know, either you're making choices based on your own personal play style. You know, it's like, oh, this is the way how I want to play the game, so I'm going to try that out. Or is something like, oh, it's actually there are optimal solutions, but there are different win conditions, and depending on which way you want to win, you will choose a different strategy, that sort of thing.
One question. Mm-hmm. So since this is a single-player game and also non-digital, so we want to make the playthrough experience defined for every playthrough, so that means there has to be some kind of drawing thing, that we are drawing something from a pile randomly, right?
It could be. It could be a physical challenge, you know, which is not necessarily the same each time around. It could have a random element, like a dice, you know, which will change what options you get. So yeah, there's a whole bunch of different ways to do that. Let's see. So now, one thing about paper prototyping is that it doesn't give you insight into everything that could be fun about a digital game. The sensory experience of, you know, the audio and the visuals and, you know, the sense of motion that you sometimes get in, especially in 3D games, but also sometimes in 2D games, that's really, really hard to prototype. On paper, and often you have to start prototyping that with, you know, either animation or actually inside the game. But I would argue that any game design will benefit from a period of paper prototyping. It doesn't answer all of your questions, but it will answer a subset of questions, especially when it comes to what decisions does the player get to make. And it allows you to sort of create a structure for the game and to think through how of the all of your different elements interact, and give you a system. Systematic approach of how your game is going to function. Most importantly, it lets you narrow down on the few things that on your game that might be fun, and then sort of figure out what's kind of extraneous, maybe nice to have, but not as necessary to have, and what decisions absolutely have to be there. There's a side benefit to making a paper prototype that I every time I do this becomes increasingly more important. With any team that I work with. And that's, it helps get the conversation within a team started about what game you're trying to make in the first place. Because right now, even if you say, I'm going to make the tag AI game, then everybody who just heard those two words that I said probably has a slightly different idea of what that game could possibly be. So by paper prototyping, the thing that you're putting on the table and that people can actually take turns trying to play will actually give you an idea of whether that's the game that we're talking about or that's the game that we're going for or that's the game that we're going for. It gives you something concrete. It's a concrete version of what's inside your head. One possibility is that everybody in your team could go away for a day and come back the next day, each with a different paper prototype. But all of a sudden, you have a much better idea of what your teammates are thinking. You have something to talk about, to communicate, and say, you know what, I like this part of this game and that part of that game. Is there a way that we can put them together? You know, so you can all get on the same page. Or you might have a prototype that just like absolutely is terrible and then decide that's not the game we're making. And it's very, very useful communication tool. Let's see. It's useful to have a written treatment or a design document, especially in a large-scale digital game. But when it comes to actually just communicating how a certain complex system works, prototypes are kind of the way to do it, both paper and also in digital prototypes for really, really huge computer games. Just mocking something up that works, you know, like Excel sheets, for instance, to show how certain game balancing elements work can be really, really handy. Something that people can actually play with the variables and see what the results of their decisions are. Okay. And finally, just back to the point, it allows you to bring in people from outside your team. By the end of this weekend, assuming that your team meets this weekend to work on this project, you're all going to be really crappy testers of your own game. You'll know too much about what this game is supposed to be or what this game is trying to be. You know too much about what this game was in previous iterations, and that's going to affect your decision-making process. You will think that there are things in the rules that you actually haven't written down, and you're going to play it that way. The nice thing about a paper prototype is that you can put it in front of somebody who's never seen the game before, and they're going to make decisions, and you're going to get a lot of insight about what's missing in your game, or maybe what's overkill in your game. The people who are testing your game don't necessarily need special skills. You know, you can bring it, if you're working on a very large digital game, you can get feedback from your QA people, your artists, your designers, your producers, even your finance people. You know, it's like can sit down and actually play a paper prototype, and you can start getting feedback from them. It's great for building team buy-in in that sense, especially from in a large project. Prototypes are interactive, so you can actually user test certain decisions before you actually go ahead and implement those features in a game. You can decide whether this feature is actually going to improve the gameplay at all before you start writing a single line of code. And if you produce several different kinds of prototypes and have the same person test all of them, it's much easier for them to give you feedback of, I like that version better, or this version better, than to just ask them, you know, so what did you think of this game? And so it's like, well, what do I have to compare it against? You know, of course, if you're working in an established genre, maybe to compare it to other games in the same genre. But if you're making something very unique, you know, it's much easier to just give them different versions, different prototypes that you've been working on, and then let them give you opinions based on what they've seen. Let's see. One caveat is that players, especially players who've gone through a game design class, like the classes that I teach or this class, will often give you feedback that is, you know what you should do? You should do this to your game. That's useful advice, but treat that kind of information with caution. You want to figure out, you have to take that feedback back to your team and as a team decide, does that actually fit what we're trying to do with the game? Because it could be two things. One, their advice could be genuinely accurate, helpful, and solve exactly a problem that you have with your game, and that's awesome. It could be that what they are seeing in your game is something very different from what you were trying to accomplish in the first place. It's like, you know, yep, they're going to play a strategic game or something, and then it's like, man, you know, my adrenaline was high, and I couldn't play those cards fast enough, and things like that. It's like, that's not the game we were trying to build. But this player is making a suggestion based on what this player, what he or she thinks the appeal of this game is. And that's useful feedback because now you can ask two questions. One, we need to change the way how our game works so that it's closer to what we had originally imagined it. Or B, there is something that our game is doing that we didn't expect but people seem to be enjoying. And you can make a decision on which way are you going to go. I have worked on many, many projects where it's like the thing that actually turned out to be the most fun in the game was not part of the original spec. It was something that accidentally happened in gameplay and it turned out to be more interesting than anything that we developed because it emerged out of the rules that we had created. It wasn't something that we had predefined. But testing is not a replacement for direction. It's not a replacement for a good vision, for a good goal that you're trying to work towards. Testing just gives you feedback on whether you're getting closer or further away from that goal. So don't let your testers design the game for you, basically. So useful tools, big sheets of paper. Yeah, some of you are very familiar with this by now. Index cards, I just handed out a whole bunch of them. Dice, both 6-sided and 20-sided and 10-sided and whatever, we had those. One recommendation I have, don't buy dice from game stores. They are really freaking expensive when you buy them from game stores. Buy them from math supply stores for teachers, and buy them in bulk. And then, you know, I think for $14 I got something like 100 dice off different types. It's like $14. It's like that will get me 3 dice, you know, if I went to a game store. Pencils, pens, markers, scissors, tape, we're talking about, you know, elementary school craft material here, right? Post-its and post-it glue actually is something I need to explain. We just talked about dice. Post-it glue is this stuff. It basically takes any piece of paper, it turns any piece of paper into a post-it. You rub it at the back and then you can stick it up on the wall, you can stick it onto other sheets of paper. It's great for when you're developing paper prototypes, you're often just using like 8.5 and 11 sheets of paper and cutting them up and things like that. These things fly if someone sneezes. So something like this can be really, really handy just to keep everything in place. You can just buy this in any office supply store. It's even Scotch brand, so it's the same brand as Post-it. Any kind of game bits that you can fluge from other board games are probably useful. Again, kindergarten counting pieces are really, really useful. The kindergarten counters that we have all have unique aspects to them. You know, the blocks can be stacked. The discs that we have can also be stacked, but then when they stack, they're a little bit more secure than just putting blocks on top of each other. We have these pieces that interlock, kind of like Legos. The danger with them is that these are prototyping material. This is not even the same medium that you're going to be making a digital game out of. And you may get so enamored with how some of these feel in a tactile way on what they can do physically that it ends up changing the way how your entire game works. Like, maybe your game has nothing to do with interlocking blocks, but because you're prototyping with interlocking blocks, it suddenly becomes a game about interlocking blocks. You want to watch out for that. Sometimes it can lead you down very interesting design paths, but often it can just lead you, you know, astray. It just locks you in a particular dimension. For instance, our rectangular blocks. Any team that prototypes with that tends to think of their game as a grid, and you can see why, right? You know, all these blocks are cubes. So if you put them together, they naturally form a grid. But a grid may not necessarily be the best idea for a game that you're making. So keep that in mind. You know. Be aware that every single one of our little prototyping pieces imposes its own constraint. And you might want to try your same idea with different pieces, like pennies or paper clips, you know, using dice as pieces, which might be kind of interesting because they have a number on each side. Don't forget to keep a record of what you're working on with your phone cameras, with a photocopier. What I suggest is actually using index cards and writing your rules on them so that you can rearrange them, but you also have a written version of your rules that you can just put together in a deck and, you know, and save for reference. So these are the kinds of useful tools. Out here are more sort of kindergarten counters. Keep it very rough. Don't try to make it pretty. If the prettier you try to make it, the more your feedback, the feedback that you're going to get is going to be about whether something looks good or not. And at this point of time, that's not the feedback you need. You don't need people to comment on your handwriting. You want people to just say, I know this is rough, I know this is ugly, ignore that, you know, we're just going to go into the decision-making process here. So keep it sketchy, keep it big. This is too big, but you know the heart is in the right place. This is a room size prototype of something that was going to run on a computer screen, and I would suggest just using one ink because then again, if you use multiple inks, people are going to start questioning your color choices. So you know, just like use a dark red or a dark black and be fine. I'll keep it hand drawn and sketchy. I already talked about writing your rules on cards. The nice thing about cards is that you can actually take rules out or rearrange how they run, and then you can see and you can play through a game pretty easily that way. Every time you change a rule, make sure that you're writing down a record of that changed rule. Grab a new card and write a new version of the card down. If you're putting your rules on a computer screen, you know, make sure that's amended. Don't try to play through a game without an actual record of what game you're playing through. Periodically take photos with your camera. And for the sake of both this exercise and for prototyping in general, you want to be trying to simplify. You want to be trying to find out what are the rules you don't need, because that's not actually helping your game be more fun or less fun. Those are not the core of your game. Eventually, there's going to be tons of things in your game that your game actually doesn't need, like you know, extra sound effects, extra art particles, background, and that may be very good for sort of improving the aesthetics of your game. In fact, all of Project 3 is going to be about the aesthetic of your game. But for the prototype stage, you don't want to be obsessing about that. You want to be obsessing about the decision-making process and whether the decisions that the player gets to make up is fun. Okay, so that's what is. So to prototype, you're going to take all of these things and going to put together a little game, a set of rules, and then what do you do with that? And the answer is you test. You have people who are going to play a game. In the case of a single-player game, you need one person. You need somebody to pretend to be the computer, and that person is often also the facilitator in the sense of that person will introduce these are the rules that you're going to be playing with, and these are the things that you can do, these are the things that you can do. And from now on, I'm going to be kind of this dispassionate wall, and I'm going to pretend to basically be a program running through instructions. And then, most important of all, the rest of the team should be taking notes, observing, taking notes, and for the most part, not talking. You don't want to be interfering with someone's decision-making process. You can ask them, what are you thinking now? That's pretty much the only bit of conversation that observers should have, just to get them to sort of verbalize what they're doing. Now, many of you are going to be doing this particular kind of test, which is the Wizard of Oz test. And I'm actually going to demonstrate this right now. So I need a volunteer who, come on up, to play a card game with me. And I'm going to try to put this up on screen so that you can see what's going on the table. Everyone else can see what's going on the table. Although that little... Yes. Pull one chair up. Okay. All right. So, your name is?
Tyler.
All right. So, this is a game that is based on, that is kind of like a real-time strategy game. Have you ever played a real-time strategy game? Okay. So these are the things you have, this area. Actually, let me turn this screen a little bit more. These are the things that you have. These are the things that you could buy. Okay. Here is the tech tree. Everything, your economy largely depends on whether you have farms and or wells. If you have two farms, then you can buy up to two of anything in any given turn. So two farms worth of things. If you have two farms, you can buy one barracks.
Okay. Is there any limit on how many farms you can have?
No, but you can. But if you notice, each farm itself costs two farms.
Right.
So it takes time for you to add new farms. I will be playing your opponent, but I can also tell you that I will be playing a very random opponent. And as you play this game, it's a turn-based game, I am going to be giving you more options. These are all the options that you currently have.
What's the goal?
The goal is to attack me and defeat me by building up an army and sending it.
Okay.
So I'm not going to. Okay. To the way how you say how you attack me is to give me cards and say these are attacking.
Or
if you want to, yeah. If I defend, you may lose them.
Okay. Should I go now?
Yes. So imagine this is like a computer game and your finger is like a cursor. Mm-hmm. All right. Okay, can other people see what's going on? Yeah? Okay.
What's in the center?
The center, this.
This is farm, this is well, this is barracks.
Yeah. You want me to move this a little closer? Sure. People are definitely welcome to do that. I'm trying to move this a little closer. Can you move this?
I'm the way too.
Come on up. I'm going to try to turn this around so that people can actually read what you're reading to.
So come on up and be hands on.
Okay. That's a little better. Okay. So, so just click on things. Yeah. Okay. Okay. All right, your turn. Is that a little better? We'll try our best. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I got a well and a squire.
Let's move these forward a little bit so the camera can get them too. That's it, right? Okay. You're being attacked by three squires. That's all I'm telling you. Use your finger to select what you are going to click on. I can tell you whether it's something you can click on.
He's being attacked by three squires.
Okay. Oh, is it because it's out of screen or is it?
They can't hear you.
Oh, they can't hear me. Okay. All right. All right. So I said you are being attacked by three squires. Click on something. Okay. And what happens is. And these go back. All right. All right. So that's pretty much all the time I had for the demo. Playing out this game actually takes more like half an hour. So I'm just going to end here. Thank you very much. Okay. So you see the basic idea, right? I wasn't actually explaining how to play this game. I did say that it was based on a real-time strategy type of type of genre, which allowed me to get away with things like, here's a tech tree. You know, I don't have to necessarily explain the tech tree, but I did not explain so much like, how do I actually buy anything? I did say, this is how much something costs, because that's necessary to be able to read the tech tree. I basically gave the player just enough to be able to start clicking on things, and oddly enough, he just kept clicking on things that actually could do something. He could have clicked on something that wouldn't have done anything, and it would have I would have just said, you can't do that. That never actually came up, but you know, if he had, I would have done that. I was being basically trying to be as much of a computer as possible. There were times where, of course, I asked the class, and I asked him to make sure, to verify whether what I thought that he did, I understood what he did. But for the most part, it was trying to be as dispassionate, as uninformative as possible, despite the only information I'm giving him is what I'm putting down in front of him as options that he can click on. I even said click on, right? I didn't even say point at. You know, I just say use your finger to click on, as if these were buttons on screen. This was actually all that I was doing. I was revealing all the options that were available to him based on decisions that he had already made. And for me, I was just rolling a dice to decide what I was going to do. If I was attacked, I would put all my units to defense. If I was not being attacked, I would put all of my units up to attack. And then I would resolve combat. I have a separate set of rules for resolving combat that I have in memory. No matter what he did, I would be following the script. Each turn, same thing over and over again. I would never deviate from the script. I'd be a computer. So the idea of the Wizard of Oz test is that somebody's playing the computer. I'm being very constrained in what I'm saying. I have very fixed rules, both the rules that I share, which are actually minimal, and the rules that I actually have to operate, which are actually extensive. If anybody's interested in this, I'm going to be putting up a blog post, and you can play this entire game as a two-player game. And I'm trying really not to give a clue about how do any of these rules work internally, because in a real computer game, a real player has no idea what the computer is thinking. The real player can only intuit what the computer is doing based on what the computer shows. So what I'm showing is very, very important. And a test like this is very informative for me to know whether what I'm showing is actually enough information for a player to make a good decision. In this particular case, actually, he was playing this pretty well. That was a good defense. You took no damage. You lost a few units, but you took no damage. And I was actually in pretty bad state compared to what you were at. So you design some play test. Based on that feedback, you revise, and then you do it all over again. You make changes to your game. Sometimes that revision is, man, that was a bad idea. Throw it away. The very first version of this game that I made was completely scrapped. It was this terrible fog of war. Every base that you build will be underneath an index card. There were index cards everywhere by the end of the game. It was terrible. But that's the nice thing about prototyping, is that you can throw stuff away. This one, this page, I will go through in more detail on Monday. This is what you do when you get stuck. I don't think I'm going to go into too great details, but there's a bunch of strategies they can do. It's like, all right, we've tried a whole bunch of different ideas, and none of them seem to be working. What do we do? So I'll get back to this on Monday. I do want to bring up that there are different kinds of tests for different kinds of games. Player versus player games. This game, like I mentioned earlier, is actually a two-player game. Most of the testing I did on this game was not what I just did, which was the Wizard of Oz test. I did a player versus player game. It was pretty much the same thing as testing a party game or a board game or a card game. It's very cooperative, it's very competitive. It's very cooperative, or you can make it competitive, but it's always like people have to kind of mutually agree on the rules, even if that's not necessarily the rules that you wrote down on a piece of paper. Like, if they read through it differently from how you wrote it, then that's the game that they're going to play. So it gets a little bit loose. Players can negotiate rules among themselves, and as a tester, sometimes you don't have much control over that. People may just decide to play it the way that you hadn't designed it. But that's useful information as well, because that means you're playing a game variant that you hadn't necessarily designed. A facilitator is still useful to explain rules, but there's no computer role. You can do games that are either symmetrical or asymmetrical, so like everyone has the same role or everyone has very different roles. All of those things are possible. There's the live action game, which is not for today's exercise, but you could do this over the weekend. If you want to prototype a game which is pretty much, here's a person walking around a space, and you know, God knows there's more than you know enough digital games that are basically a person walking around in a space, then live action prototyping might be just fine. The only problem with live action prototyping is that you can explain the rules to a person or to a group of people, and they're all going to play out this game, and they're all limited by what the number of rules that they can keep on your head. It's really, really hard to sort of refer back to rules. Even people who play live action role playing games, you know, on a regular basis, maybe they can hold a slightly larger range of rules, but a lot of that is actually based on variants of rules they've already played before. So it's a little bit easier. That being said, they can just interpret the rules differently from everybody else, and you might actually have five different people playing actually five different sets of rules all simultaneously, and as someone who's running the test, it's really hard to tell that they're all playing different sets of rules. But it's a really, really fast way to just get to prototyping a game where a person's walking around space. You know, stealth games, for instance. Normally you would explain those rules at the beginning of the game, set them off, and then get them, then come back and then get their feedback based on how that game went. So I've done all three styles. So if anybody wants to get more information on conducting one of these other kinds of tests, not the Wizard of Oz test, which I actually just demonstrated, please do ask me after class. So we've got about 15 minutes left. All right. Okay.
20.
All right, so any questions about what I'm asking you to do over the weekend?
Yeah. For the computer, is the computer allowed to run like an AI, for example, if your game is like a board game?
Yes, but it should literally be a set of rules governing what the computer is doing. If this, then that. You know, in the case of, if variable is more than this, then that, right? It shouldn't be a game master. You're not a dungeon master or a game master hiding behind your shield, you know, making an arbitrary decision on the fly.
Could also be rolling. There could also be like roll a d20 on a 1 through 5. It does this on a 2 on whatever, and so forth. So it doesn't have to be just a pure logic based. And also, you're resolving the random encounters.
In my case, it was something like if I roll 1, 2, 3, I will buy something. I will build a building. If I roll 3. If I roll 1, 2, 3, I will build a unit. If I roll 4, 5, 6, I will build a building. The next building that I come back. That was pretty much it. That was my algorithm.
Any other questions?
So, like, what do you recommend for? I guess maybe for this assignment, since it's just a prototype. If we're in the spirit of doing it for a computer game or whatever, if we have like a real time game where like the physics being like messed with as part of the game,
then you probably want to choose prototyping materials that give you an idea of how those physics are going to work out, right? If your physics is going to be like a sphere moving, you know, effectively like a super monkey ball type thing, you know, you got a ball, then actually use a ball, right? You know, that will give you a little bit of a sense of where you want to get.
One physical prototype I've seen was someone going to a maze gate. Trying to be out of rotating sections. So they had a ball inside of a box, inside of another box, and they rolled the box around, and they had a small hole to try to drop that one out of, and they basically repeated it. So they just sort of created the physical setup. And they acknowledged that it was not going to be quite the same, but they went for as much as possible. They were, you know, building, if you're trying to use some sort of impossible contraption thing, you might have a pile of rubber bands, a pile of paper clips, and say, okay, here's your rubber bands, here's your paper clips, here's your toothpicks, burn down this house.
Yeah.
Build a device that does that, and here's your tools.
Okay, like I guess that. Maybe slightly more specifically, do you have any tips for paper prototyping, like very platformy sort of games?
I will say something like do it that you could do it on a grid, a square grid, for instance, and just say like, hey, jump is this many squares up, this many squares to the side,
okay.
That sort of thing, and just resolve it as simple as possible. The question isn't, are the jump, do these jump physics feel right? The question is jumping even interesting in this game?
Okay.
You know, is this an interesting decision to make? The thing about the ball in the maze prototype is that. It wasn't very useful in determining, in getting player feedback, but it was incredibly useful for the team that built that to say, this is the game we're building. We're going to go straight to digital prototype after having made that paper prototype, even though it was difficult to play with because the physics weren't quite right, and it was difficult to get player feedback, but it was extremely valuable for the team to say, yeah, this is how it's going to work. This is how, well, first digital version is going to work. So... slightly less on the player feedback, slightly more on the team communication.
So what are we turning in? What are we turning in after we do the testing?
I think we're doing a test in class, right?
Yeah, we're doing basically the way that Wednesday's going to work is we have, we've introduced the project today because we can work on it. We have a small amount of time to work on it in class on Monday. Possibly some time to run some in-class testing with some people not on your team.
Yes, I do.
Wednesday, we will kick off Project 2. Next Wednesday, we'll kick off Project 2. And you'll spend the first half of the period basically dealing with the kickoff and forming teams. And then the next hour and a half, we'll have a sign-up sheet for people to sign up on, for teams to sign up on. And we'll come and grab the Project 1 teams in about 10-minute increments to grab you, have you play the game with the instructors over in the Gambit Lounge, and then you'll come back and continue working on your team in the second half of the class. So we'll grab people out sort of sequentially to have you demonstrate your game.
Cool. Yeah. All right. Now class is yours. So who's got an idea that you want to build a team around? Okay, front and back.
All right, so should I just give a little
Bit
more? Sure, so I wrote, for example, one idea I was working on was kind of like a backwards minus touch game, where whatever you touched in the game, you could name the properties of that. So like you could touch water and become like able to go through small holes or something. You touch stone and you get heavier.
So what do you have written on your card? So that
I'm going to write
backwards minus touch.
Minus touch.
Okay.
So my idea was something like Scrabble except with poker hands. So the basic idea is that you have grid and you have cards or something, and you're trying to make or you're trying to put the cards on the grid so that all of them are making poker hands. And you could probably change that so that it's not just poker and some other kind of cards.
So what do you have written on your card?
Poker Scrabble.
Poker Scrabble. Okay. So for everyone who's got stand up and move somewhere on the side of the classroom so that people can find you. I assume that everyone's declared.
I was thinking some sort of like roguelike dungeoneering labyrinth game where you're a character inside of the labyrinth and the labyrinth is randomly generating pieces. So the goal is it's kind of like an RPG with fighting and you try to get out of the labyrinth essentially.
So a roguelike dungeon crawler.
Yeah.
What do you have written on your card?
Roguelike RPG board game.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Yep. So find a place to do it. It could be in front or the back. It's up to you. Who's next?
QWERTY Hero, basically Rock Band or Guitar Hero, but with the keyboard. So you'd be typing words, and then at the end it might tell you what you said, and wonders the ridiculous thing.
Assume you wrote down QWERTY Hero.
Yeah.
Okay.
Would that be a digital game?
That would be, well, not for Project 1. For Project 1, it would be a paper prototype of that game.
I've got a deck building monster fighter where it's kind of like Dominion where you build up your deck, but the point of the game is to defeat a monster at the end.
Deck building monster fighter.
Yeah.
Okay, alright. Sure. you can only get one team at a time.
Okay, yeah, that's fine. So I was thinking of one, I'm calling it Darwinian chess, where you play like on a subset of a chessboard maybe, and then it has history, so if you like the pieces that survive might get an upgrade, or you could have it be like kind of backwards, like the pieces that were killed off are the only pieces you get to use off the next game, but something where it has history and now it's like a smaller sort of chess.
Darwinian chess is a good thing to write on the card. All right. Do you need another card? No, you got it. Okay.
I got one.
Right. Anyone else? Yeah.
Like a Fire Emblem type tower defense game where there's a set of towers that you have to go against and you have a set of heroes with the specific attributes, and there's different towers as well with specific attributes. And the point of the game is like use your moves or dice roll or whatever to move around the board to get to the towers, and you destroy the towers before they destroy you, or just wipe out the towers with the least amount of people lost from your game.
Okay, so minimize losses from towers.
I'll call it tower offense.
Tower offense, so. Isn't that a MOBA? No, that's very close to that.
Is it already trademarked, or can I not?
Oh, no. No, tower offense is an awesome name. Run with that. Maybe it's trademark, but I don't know. Google it.
We just, we don't care.
Yeah. My game is going to be about, like, that house rush. You can buy, like, upgrades for your house, and then the game will be randomized because, like, I don't know, your toilet can clog, or, like, a comet can come down. But basically, the goal will be, like, there will be, like, rival fraternities as well, and your goal is to get as many rushies as possible. So,
okay. So,
we called up.
Friend house rush. Right.
So the idea is to basically you are a ninja, but you're a pacifist. So it's and also there's, for some reason, it's like two opposing teams. But basically the idea is you're trying to get opposing teams to kill each other. So there might be guards that are walking at each other, or like walking close by, and you throw a rock in between them, and they like both go to that sound source, and they kill each other. And you are trying to steal something along those lines.
I'm not sure that's exactly pacifism, but that might
be. I'm going to call it pacifist ninja.
Yeah.
Right.
So we had an idea about a game where one of the make. So there is a Tyrannosaurus who is trying to chase you in some space. But you can
be dinosaurs in space. Is that right?
Tyrannosaurus Rex. T-Rex.
Specifically, T-Rex in space. Got
yes.
Okay.
T-Rex is trying to chase you around a closed space, and you can move around to avoid him. But the mechanic is that if you stand still, then he can't detect where you are. So
okay.
He will move around randomly.
So it's like the Jurassic Park kitchen game.
Yeah.
Dinosaurs.
Okay.
The idea would be like kind of like a one of those like Diablo-esque games, but with where you make plays for a small team of like three.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't actually have direct control. You just design a few plays and try to get through the encounter based off the plays that you wrote.
Okay.
Playmaking game.
Yeah. That's not football. That is like a dungeon.
That's what I was thinking.
Anti-boss.
Flexible on the aesthetic.
Okay. All right. Cool. Taking down enemies of some sort.
Yeah.
Well, one would argue, actually, that we're just like adapting the whole Madden playmaking kind of thing for combat. It's, yeah, that's yeah. Any other ideas? Yeah.
Thinking about an escape game. So it could be any type of escape. It could be like office supplies escape, like paper clip trying to escape, or your laundry escape, your socks missing,
uh-huh.
Or stuff like that. So escape-based game.
So sort of inanimate object trying to escape.
Yeah.
Okay.
And you're trying to figure out which one is missing.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
So
you're
not playing the escape B, you are playing someone
figuring out.
What's
yeah.
missing. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, what are you going to write down in your card?
Escape.
Just escape. Okay. Makes sense. Any more?
How many people are there per
team? Maximum, actually, minimum four. Well, we're actually expecting
four
per team.
We think it would be wiser if you don't go over four.
Or just.
And if you end up with three people who don't fit into a team, that's okay to have it the first team. But we would like to aim for four. We understand that numbers don't always work out perfectly.
it is very likely that some of the people currently standing up will end up working on some other project, just the way how the numbers work out right now. So all of you should be talking with each other. I think, was there more hands? Okay, so how the rest of this works is now, for the rest of class, you all just talk with each other. Make sure that you leave class with the team. As soon as you have a team of four, you can pack up and go and have a discussion somewhere else.
But you may want to collect some shiny